Yeah, he's pretty cerebral fella.
Yeah, you know? Cerebral?
Cerebral. Is that the right word? Cerebral?
I don't think it is, but I don't know enough about it to correct you. So just,
it is a
word.
I thought
it was cerebral. Cerebral?
Cerebral. Cerebral?
Yeah, let's go with that.
Brainy.
Brainy.
Yeah.
Real heady guy.
Hold on to your butts. It's the Mast Cast.
On this week's episode of the Mast Cast, former Cup Series driver Rick Mast and his son Ricky recap the race in Atlanta. We open up the Rictionary of racing terminology. We share some memories of the late great Davey Allison. We have Rick's quote of the week. And we explore the story of how Rick used a farm animal to acquire his first race car. Well, Dad, apparently, when you make your own podcast, you can't be canceled because we're back for a second episode.
You know what was, you know, one of the funniest things that happened, Ricky, last week? Somebody listened to the podcast and they got on my page on Twitter and told me that they really enjoyed the podcast, but they were really surprised. They didn't think I knew what a podcast was, number one, or number two, how to even do a podcast. And I was sitting there thinking, listen, dude, I just turned 59 or 60. I'm not from the dark ages. I do know a little bit about modern technology. So that was kind of disheartening, to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, I mean, once you've got your age narrowed down to a 2 or 3 year range, then yeah, that gives you plenty of time to focus on all this new technology and stuff too, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, you're the one supposed to be doing that. So everybody out there listening, yes, I do in fact know what a podcast is. No, I'm not sure how all of it works. All I know is you speak into mics and you listen through your earbuds and it all goes out into the stratosphere. And somewhere it's collected and sent back. Which reminds me one time, somebody you know very well talking about the cloud. Everything goes into the iCloud or the cloud. And they were thinking, where is that cloud located? And I'm like, dude, it's a big building somewhere with a bunch of computers in it. It's not really a cloud. Oh, okay. I got you now.
All right, Dad. Atlanta, yesterday. What'd you think?
I think Harvick waxed those guys' ass is what I think.
I mean, yeah, I think you're right.
I don't know how else to put it. I mean, you know, the weird part, when they talked about it, that's the first time he'd won there in 17 years for the very first time right after Earnhardt got killed. I did not realize that. I thought he'd won half a dozen races there just because he dominated so many events there. And I just assumed he'd won a bunch of them. And lo and behold, he hadn't won in 17 years. So he was definitely due. And he had him waxed. I don't know how else to put it. He had him waxed. One of the neat parts, he was talking to Childress, Rodney Childress, the crew chief. And they were asking him, you know, what's the deal with Harvick? He said, I don't really know. He said, I've got more data than anybody has on Harvick here and looking at everything, but I don't have any idea why he's so good. But you have tracks just like that. You'll have different tracks that require different things, and a driver has to feel a certain thing at a certain point on the racetrack. One of those tracks for me was always Dover. I knew at Dover when I dropped in the turn, I knew when to get out of the gas. I knew what the car had to feel like leading into the center, leading into the apex. I knew exactly what the car needed to do and how it needed to feel and what it needed to do when I got in the gas. And a lot of times we're able to quickly get those adjustments in the car and make it do what I wanted it to do. Consequently, we always ran good. Rockingham was like that for me. And obviously Atlanta's that way for Harvick.
Yeah, clearly is. I was the same as you when they said he hadn't won since his first win back in 01. That floored me. I couldn't believe it. All right, so the big topic, it seems like every time they come to Atlanta now, and I want to get your opinion on it because I'm just the guy pushing all the buttons here on the podcast. I don't know anything about racing surfaces and pavement or not paving. Should they repave Atlanta or should they not, and why?
Well, the reason that the guys, especially Junior last year, Earnhardt Jr., didn't want to do it is that the track, you can go to that racetrack and you can race right on the yellow line where Harvick was all day, or you can move up against the wall where Larson likes to run, or you can run in the middle. The track's always been kind of conducive to that. You can do that, especially with a wore out service, a surface. When you pave a racetrack and it's brand new, and we went through a lot of that back in the 90s and especially the late 90s, they were repaving all these racetracks. You'd go and the car would just be stuck unbelievably. You couldn't imagine how good the car was stuck to this new pavement. And you'd run a few laps, and everybody run a few laps where you had one little groove that everybody was running in, and it would stick a little bit better. And that's where everybody ran. And you're going tremendously, you're carrying a tremendous amount of speed. And if you'd move out of that area during the course of the weekend, you didn't quite have as much grip and you couldn't race anybody. You couldn't slide the car. In other words, the car is either stuck or it's wrecking. That's kind of the way it works. The Atlanta surface with an old wore out surface what these drivers are feeling, especially the young ones that never felt bias ply tires. It's kind of like a bias ply tire, and I call it wallering around. The car is wallering around a little bit, and the car slips and slides a little bit, and you work the steering wheel, you work the gas, you can do things with as a driver to, you can move grooves, you go up, down, you do a lot of things, and it makes it much better for the driver to try to control what's going on. Whereas with a new surface, yeah, the driver's pretty much stuck. You go in the turn wide open, you burp the gas, the car takes a set, you hold the steering wheel, and you rake back in it wide open real quick, and the car is just stuck, and you go all around the turn that way, you come off the corner, and that's the way it is. And you don't really get out of the gas, you can't really race anybody hard. But when the surface is wore out or you got a real, real hard tire, it puts it back in the driver's hand. And that's why these drivers don't want them to pave Atlanta.
Now, define wallering around for me.
Well, I'll tell you, Ricky, a wallering, how can I say this? You got a duping, a wandering, and a wallering.
Okay. A duping, right. Wait. A duping, a wallering, and a whatin? A wandering.
A wandering.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
This is, are we opening up the Rictionary here, or is this Harry Gant speak?
I'll be honest with you. Harry Gant taught me all this.
Okay. Even wallering?
Yeah, he did.
Okay.
The first time I went to Daytona, I got in Travis Carter's car. People remember that in 89. We go to Daytona, and I'm going to run Travis Carter's car in the Busch Clash and the Daytona 500. And first time down there in a cup car. Well, the year before that, the years preceding that, Harry Gant drove for Travis, and it was a Skoal Bandit team. Well, that year at the end of 88, Harry and Travis separated. Harry went to Leo Jackson, and Travis, basically without a sponsor, without a team. He still had his team intact, didn't have a driver or sponsor. So anyhow, I show up to drive it. We go to Daytona for the first test, and the first time I go on the racetrack, right before I go out, the guys on the crew come to me, they whisper, they say, Rick, listen, when you got on the racetrack, when you come in, now, what's going to happen? Travis is going to come in the car. He's going to take a net down, and he's going to lean in the window. He's going to ask you what I think. So what you got to do is tell him, Travis, it's a duping. And I said, what? They said, just tell him it's a duping. I said, okay. So I go out on the track, and I practice a few laps. I come in. Travis comes in the car, pulls the net down. He said, what do you think, driver? I said, well, Travis, I'm kind of experienced at these cup cars, but it's to me, it's just kind of like it's a duping. He says, it's a what? Yeah, I said, it's a duping. He looked at me real strange. He turned around. He walked away. He went to the back of his truck and laid down on this cushion on the back of his truck, and just laid there with his hands over his head. And all the crew guys were just dying laughing. Well, come to find out, the year before, Harry and Travis, you know, as relationships go, they're two of the best people in the world you'd ever meet. But sometimes you grow apart and things, you have a little friction, things don't work. Well, one of the races towards the end of the year, Harry comes in, they're not running good and they're not communicating. And Harry comes in off the track and goes to Travis and tells Travis, it's a duping. Well, Travis don't know what a dupe means. And it evidently aggravated Travis a lot. So, and he must have said something about it. So, but anyhow, come to find out what a dupe is. If your car is wandering, that means it's steering itself from the left to the right. Okay.
Okay.
If it's bouncing, a bouncing means it's going up and down.
Wait a minute. So that's another one.
I forgot about the, well, I forgot.
The formula
that makes a dupe is a wandering and a bouncing. If it's wandering, it's going from side to side. Okay.
Okay.
Everybody understands that. If it's bouncing, it's going up and down.
Okay.
The car's jumping up and down. If it's a duping, that's a cross between a wandering and a bouncing. okay? And it's kind of like you take your hands and fold them in and out. The car's not really bouncing. It's not really wandering. It's a duping, and it's steering itself and jumping up and down at the same time. That's what a dupe is. Now, a waller is just when you go in the turn and the car just kind of wallers. You know, the back will slide out some or the front will slide out some, sure. But you still got control of the car, you know. And that's what happens with a hard tire or an old racing service like Atlanta. The car is always wallering around. You know, if you put a new surface down or a soft tire, it don't waller. You're stuck or you're wrecked. It's pretty simplistic when you think about it.
No, oh, yeah, it's real simplistic indeed. All right, well, while we're talking about this, I got one. Since we're into this Rictionary speak here, one thing I saw you use on Twitter recently, and we'll get back to Atlanta here momentarily. Since we got a duping, a wandering, wallering, a bouncing. Wait, is it wallering or a wallering? It's just wallering, right?
It's just waller, not a waller.
Oh, okay.
Just,
all right.
Just waller. There's a big difference.
Yeah, sure. Well, what about, I saw you tweet the word a punkst a week or two ago. What does a punkst mean? I think he's APONKST, I think is how you spelled it. I think you said Daytona 500 is a punkstus.
It's a punkstus. It's upon us. You can use the correct terminology, say upon, or you can say it's here, or it's coming. A punkstus. It's on us. It's here. Okay. Let me tell you something, dude. When you race the Busch Grand National Series in the 80s, against all those guys from Western Carolina and Eastern Tennessee, you learn a lot of these words. This is not all Virginia slang here. This is some of my fellow brethren in the Busch series where I picked up on a lot of this stuff.
Okay, so one thing I was thinking about watching the Atlanta race yesterday into last night was, and I'll expand on this, was this type of race sort of an old school style race? And what I mean by that is I wonder if sometimes folks these days have romanticized versions of old school NASCAR in that every race was like down to the wire, you know, Petty and Pearson at Daytona, Earnhardt and DW at Richmond, Dale Jarrett and Davey Allison at Michigan, if it was that type of racing, when in fact, yesterday was really more like what we used to see a lot of, in which, you know, not every race came down to the wire and we didn't have overtime. I mean, I was watching that race yesterday thinking, yeah, you know, we used to see a lot of these types of races. Not everything comes down to the last minute. Sometimes somebody just runs away with it or just waxes everybody's ass, as you just put it. Now, that being said, I actually thought the strategy of the race with Denny and Logano going for one strategy and everybody else on another there for a while, I actually thought it made it a pretty entertaining race. So two questions was it a more of an old school type race? And then also didn't that make it kind of an entertaining race?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely old school race. I mean, we hear so many people criticizing today, talking about the old days and how good it was, and it was good, but the actual competition on the racetrack was real, real similar to what we saw at Atlanta. And, you know, with the cars wallering around, of course, and the guys stretching out. And I mean, we just, you know, there wasn't side by side battles for the lead every single lap of every race all through the 70s, 80s, 90s. It wasn't that way. I mean, it's kind of like we watch Daytona now in Talladega, and we think every racetrack should be just like that. The cars all should be grouped together. It's not the way it works. Racing is always about a lot of different things. The competition, running close to each other, trying to pass the guy. Yeah, you did that, but you tried to get away from him, and the field would stretch out. Then your crew chiefs would take over, and they'd start working on fuel strategy, pit strategy, everything they could do to get to them. Because here's the deal. A race is all about what you're trying to do is you're trying to race to be the first. Let me explain this, Ricky. Don't make fun of me. But
no, I wouldn't dream of it.
You're trying to be the first one to get to the checkered flag. Okay?
Oh.
You're trying. Mark Martin had a way of putting it that was better than the way I'm trying to explain it to you. But what it amounts to, you're trying to be the first guy to get to the checkered flag, whatever that takes. And that doesn't mean at lap 210 of a 500-mile lap race that you're going to race a guy side-by-side for 30 laps for 10th position. Because what that does, you're slowing your lap speed down, okay, and you're going to be slower getting to that checkered flag. If you were single file with that guy, your lap speeds would be a little bit quicker. So, you know, you pick and choose your battles, and it goes back to this type of racing that's going on right now, or it was going on in Atlanta, that was kind of like old school. You know, you're working real hard on the chassis. I mean, you see guys fighting the steering wheel a lot, and consequently, somebody during each run, somebody will have a set of tires or make an adjustment to the car that really sets sail. You know, or sometimes you'll have a car all day at a race like that that's just on a rail like Harvick's car was, and they just wax the field all day. So, but yeah, to aromatize, what did you call it? Aromatize? Is that what you called it?
That's pretty close. Yeah, that's pretty close.
I mean, we have, you know,
the correct pronunciation is amongst you.
Yeah, we have a lot of that going on with our fans right now, and to aromatize their sport from what it used to be. And they're right about a lot of things, but the actual cars being side by side on the racetrack, no, they're not right about that. Now, the one part that doesn't change from the time they drop the green flag to when the checkered flag drops, the drivers are doing the exact same thing they did when I was there, and they were doing 50 years before I was there. They were giving it everything they had. They were right on the edge. They were pushing on as low part as they could push it and doing everything they could to run as fast as they could possibly run. There's no different. That's no different today. And that's what I tell people all the time. When I got in the sport, when I was, you know, basically 15 years old and got in the race car and I strapped in, I remember the last race at Charlotte when I was so deathly ill, not feeling good. I remember strapping into the car, putting my helmet on, thinking, man, I've been doing this a lot of years. And I was sitting there thinking about how can I get ahead of this guy when this race starts so I could get in the it was an all-star race, what it was, trying to figure out how to pass this guy. And I'm thinking, you know what? Everything outside of the sport has changed and evolved. The everything about it is different and changed. But the one part that hasn't changed and remains pure is just like Ted Williams said that time, play the game for the game. Well, it's the same way with the race car. When you're strapped into the car, you got your helmet on, you're looking out the windshield, all you're thinking about is how to beat the guy in front of you. And that part never changes. It never will change. It always remains pure.
So one thing I saw over the weekend, I first saw from the widow of the late, great Davey Allison, Liz, on Twitter. She was marking, or I guess celebrating, what would have been Davey's 57th birthday. I believe it was yesterday, race day at Atlanta. Correct. And then, you know, on top of that, then, you know, I think some other places on social media were playing some old highlights from Davey, from his career. And that just kind of got me to thinking, you know, I know he was not just a competitor of yours, but a friend also. And it made me, I started thinking of, you know, the thing is, when you lose somebody like that tragically long before their time, if nothing else, years later, it's nice that when you think of them, you kind of have good positive thoughts or good memories of them. And that's kind of what I started thinking of. So I just thought maybe we could share some old Davey memories or tales here. And well, why don't you start?
Yeah, well, Dave is one of those guys that you just had to like. If you were around him much, he's just one of those guys. He had a personality about him that you just had to like. His dad never gave him anything. Poor Davey, he worked his butt off. I remember the first time I really interacted with Davey, we were at a bush race in Dover, and I guess maybe mid-80s, before he and I ever got the cup. And the race was over, and we had to park on the dog track. The dog track is the center of the racetrack at Dover, and it's up top, and it's all sandy and dirty. Well, excuse me. Davey had wrecked his car. The race was over, and he had it jacked up, and it was tore all to pieces. And he was up under it with a big old sledgehammer and a cutting torch, trying to fix this thing good enough to get it loaded on his trailer. And I just happened to walk by, and I saw him, so I grabbed a bar or something and jumped up under the car with him and started working with him. Finally got his car loaded. So from that point on, you know, we became acquaintances, and then over a period of time, we become buddies and then pretty good friends. And Davey, man, I remember at Pocono that time, Davey flipped coming off the trioval back there in the back. Is that what they call it? The tunnel turn. That's
tunnel
what it was.
Turn,
tunnel
yeah.
turn. I think mm-hmm. he and Daryl got together, and I was right behind him, and he went sideways, and the air got up on him. That thing started flipping. It was flipping, and I went by, and it was flipping in the mirror, and I'm like, my Lord. And we came back around, and, of course, the time we come back around, they put the tarp around everything. In those days, when they brought out the blue tarp, that meant it was a fatality, right?
And right.
My heart really sunk. You know, it was a bad deal. Come find out Davey was okay. The next week we go, I think it was Talladega, and we're riding a bus. They would pick us up in a bus in the infield or in the garage area and carry all the drivers out to the podium for the driver introduction at start-finish line. And we're all on the bus, and Davey got on. He had his sunglasses on, and somebody said, "What are you doing with sunglasses on, Davey?" It was real cloudy or something, I think. And somebody else got on about sunglasses. We stood up in front of everybody in the bus and took his sunglasses and pulled them down and said, "This is the reason, guys." And we looked at him, and he looked like a horror movie dude. It was, his eyes were just solid red, you know, from all those flips the week before. It was just like, and everybody went, "Put your glasses back on, man." But anyhow, my story with Davey, at the end, we were at New Hampshire, and race morning, or for the race, Dave and I walked out of the garage area together. We were walking up pit road together to get ready to go to our cars. It was after driver introduction, actually, and we were walking together. Music started playing on the loudspeaker, and Davey stopped me. He said, "Stop." I said, "Why?" He said, "National anthem." I said, "That's not national anthem." He said, "Yeah, it's Canadian. Stand still." So I did. They finished playing that. Then they played the national anthem. We walked. We got to our cars, and we shook hands. Said, "All right, Davey, see you next week." He said, "Good luck, Rick. See you next week, dude." So anyhow, I get in my car, getting ready to start the race, and before gentlemen start your engines, happened. Well, an official came up to me. He said, "Rick, we got an emergency phone call for you from home." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, they called from your home. Said your house is on fire." And I'm like, "Okay, what do I do about that, right? I'm getting ready to start the race. I get a phone call, my house is on fire." Anyhow, we run the race that day, and I don't know what we did, but anyhow, we fly home that night, and sure enough, my house had burnt. And the next morning, I think we stayed at the motel or something that night. I'm not sure. But anyhow,
we stayed down the road at Meemaw and Granddaddy's, your parents' house.
Oh, okay,
house.
Yeah. My parents' house, mm-hmm. Okay. Sorry. So the next morning we go up there, and sure enough, the house had caught on fire in the kitchen. We hadn't been there in a good while. My dad happened to be there watering the plants outside, and he kept hearing a noise, and he thought it was the cats in the house, and he couldn't see him because of the sunglare. Anyhow, the fire blew a window out, and he was able to stick the hose in the kitchen and try to knock it down. The fire department showed up on four-wheelers and riding horses and a couple trucks, and they got it knocked out, but it really destroyed just about everything inside of the house. So anyhow, that day we're walking around, and a lot of the trophies, a lot of the stuff we had, memento stuff. Is that right? Memento stuff?
Well, you would have mementos, but I think okay. What you're looking for like materials items, material stuff.
Is, yeah,
what
we had mementos, there. Material items, and all this stuff was, you know, messed up, and we're walking around. Well, that evening or sometime that day, I got a phone call that Davey had wrecked his helicopter in Talladega. So we spent that evening and that night trying to find out what it could. And I kept hearing that it was not good, you know, whatever was going on. So anyhow, the next morning rolls around, and we show up at the house again. There's a state fire marshal there. There's also a fire investigator there, and also the insurance dude was there. And me and the insurance dude, we were haggling back and forwards about the value of this and the value of that. And this had to be replaced, and that had to be replaced, and everything was a mess. Well, I was starting to get agitated a little bit with the insurance guy because it seemed like he was, you know, he wasn't being real cooperative with me. So anyhow, I get a call, and they told me that we just lost Davey. So I sit there and listen to that for a minute. They said Davey had passed earlier. So I hung the phone up. I grabbed Sharon, your mom, and my wife. I looked at the insurance agent and the fire marshals, and I said, "Listen," I said, "I don't have a problem in the damn world. Y'all do what you need to do. I'm leaving." And I walked out of the house, and I never, ever once again thought about anything to do with that fire or anything I'd lost or anything, the value or what was cherished. It just, none of it mattered after that. So that was a sad day. Let's put it that way. Very sad day. Because think about David, man. He had it going on. I mean, he could drive the crap out of a race car, and he was with Yates, and those guys had it going on at the time. And the future was real bright for Davey. Let's put it that way. And it was all snuffed out, no different than we hear in everyday life with everybody.
Yeah, it is. You know, you look, I try not to do too much of the, well, what would have happened had this not have happened, or just that what would have been kind of stuff. But the history of NASCAR, at least in the 90s, it's just, it probably would have played out a little bit differently. I think Jeff Gordon would still be a NASCAR champion, but maybe one of those titles of his would have gone to Davey, or, you know, you just don't want to go too deep into it. But man, he was just starting to really hit his peak, I think. So it's just, it was such a shame we lost him when we did. But just a couple of things to your points. I remember when we got to the house that night, that Sunday night, after the New Hampshire race, which was, of course, ended up being Davey's last race, I remember I was just a kid, but I mean, I was so upset. I mean, our house was burnt up and pretty much everything in it was destroyed. And you just felt like just the world was ending or something like that. And I remember that lesson from you after we found out Davey was gone. I just remember you pointing out to everybody that, hey, we ain't got problems. This ain't a problem. You know, and you're exactly right. And that's one of those life lessons I've held on to ever since then. A couple other things you mentioned is crash at Pocono and how scary that was. I'll tell you where I was during that. In those days, the kid, you know, drivers, kids and families, not everybody always came to the racetrack. But Pocono, I think because it was a place that the folks that run Pocono, the Mattiolis, I believe their name was. I can't
remember. It was.
Yeah. They
Rose and Dr. Joe.
Yeah. They were
Dr. Rose. Yeah.
Yeah. They were always just so cool to the drivers and all the families. And they were so, I guess, hospitable, you would say. So I remember a lot of drivers, you know, wives and kids would show up. That's where a few years later they would have a baby shower for my mom when she was pregnant with my sisters. And also Ricky Craven's wife, KK, they put on a joint baby shower for them there. And they had like this, I don't know what it was called, but it was just a building. I don't know if it was like a family center type deal, like a big lounge, basically, where drivers, kids and wives could hang out during the race. So we would all be in there hanging out, playing, whatever. And they would have the race on TV, obviously. When Davey wrecked, I mean, I'm pretty sure, I believe Livs was in there, and she was obviously pretty upset, as you would be when you see your family member, your husband, your dad, whoever, in that wreck. And I remember Robert Yates and another crew member running into the center, into that the family center to come get her, because that's how scary it was. You mentioned that tarp. I mean, yeah, the tarp was the sign of death in those days, and I guess probably still is. And so it was just thankful he was okay after that. But that's just, that's kind of how the inner workings of all that family stuff was in those days. It was when somebody wrecked like that, it was scary. Now, just to end this Davey discussion on with a fond story or a fond memory, a funny story. And I don't know if you remember this or not. This would have been Martinsville in, I'm going to say 92, I believe. Now, this is pre-everybody, every family, every driver having a, you know, million-dollar bus at the racetrack. This is when a lot of us were still, most of us, maybe all of us, were staying at hotels near the racetrack. So we were on our way to the racetrack that morning, and I made you stop. It was just me, you, and Mom. I made you stop at McDonald's because I wanted an Egg McMuffin. And that's one thing that hasn't changed, by the way. I still love Egg McMuffins. So we get in the drive-thru, you order, and then we go around the building there, and there's one car ahead of us, and it's parked in front of, not parked, but it's in front of us, and they're at that car's at the window, and it was just one guy in the car driving. And we look up, we notice that in the drive-thru window, the workers in there, there's a few ladies at the drive-thru window that are the McDonald's employees, and they're like kind of in a tizzy. Like there's, you know, they're all like excited, like you can see them all like kind of just being excited about something. And then you see like, wait a minute, I think they're getting an autograph from whoever's driving that car. Well, you keep looking, you realize it's Davey. Now, you know what? I believe we would have had a rental car, and obviously he would have too. So once you realized it was Davey, you pulled up and gave him a pretty good little shot to the bumper while he was sitting there parked. And then he looks back, and you could see his expression in the rearview mirror. I'll never forget it. And he looked pissed off pretty much at first. And then he kept looking, and he realized who it was. So then he throws it in reverse and then gives us a shot going in reverse. And the main thing I remember about this is watching those ladies in that drive-through window. They are just losing their mind, hysterically laughing, because here it is, it's 8 o'clock in the morning or whatever, they're working at McDonald's, and they got two NASCAR drivers and rental cars banging against each other in line. And then they ended up getting yours and his autographs on a McDonald's napkin, which I thought was pretty cool. So that's one of those things, when I think of Davey, that morning, just how hard I ended up laughing at that was just, man, that was a fun morning. Speaking about Days of Thunder, that was kind of like a slow version, slow version of what they did on the beach in Days of Thunder, you know?
Yeah, I remember that. I don't remember you being in the car. I didn't know you knew about that, but I guess you knew about it because you were in there. But I know there was some body damage. I know, I think we both had manufacturer's cars, and I'm not sure. I know he was in a Ford, and I'm not sure if I was in an Oldsmobile, if I'd got to Ford by then. I think I might have been an Oldsmobile. I know I had some front end damage. Davey had some rear end damage. But the neat part about it, I think both of us got a lot of the aggression out of the way before we had to start the race at Martinsville, because Martinsville, man, you had all kinds of aggression you were working with. But yeah, maybe I shouldn't gave him such a hard shot, because what happened, I think what triggered him, I gave him such a hard shot to begin with. Then when he put it in reverse, he doubled that force when he put it in reverse. And then when I put it in drive, I kind of tripled that force. And the best I remember, it ended with your mom kind of getting involved in the middle of this, I believe is the way it turned out. Maybe unbeknownst to you with everything that was going on in the front seat. But yeah, that was cool. I mean, a lot of stuff like that went on, man. You just had a lot of fun with guys. And Davey was one of those guys that I just had fun with, and he was my buddy. But, you know, it's the way it is.
All right, now, Dad, since we're doing this podcast every week, you said that you want to come up with kind of like I guess you call it like a quiz for me each week. You're gonna come in with some kind of quote, right, from some NASCAR quote, and then I have to try to guess who said it. Is that correct?
Yeah, quote of the week, Rick's quote of the week.
Rick's quote of the week, okay. All right, fire away.
All right, who said this, Ricky? This is a quote. The dude said, we never really quit working on the race cars. It just comes a point in time where you got to load them up and take them to the racetrack.
Okay. All right. Now I'm going to, in general with these quotes, I'm going to guess that it's somebody from your era or before you.
Yeah, so most of them would be, but I've got a few current ones also. I'm going to pull out here on MassCast as a year goes.
Okay. Okay. All right. All right. That's fair.
But yeah, I'll tell you this. I'll give you some hints. That came from a crew chief, which it sounded like it should have. And
yeah,
this particular crew chief was crew chief for at least two cup champion drivers, I believe. Yeah. Okay. I think I'm right about that.
Okay. All right. We'll see. The first two that came to
me. You never really quit working on the cars. You just finally load them up and take them to the racetrack.
Okay. The first two that come to mind were Junior Johnson and Maurice Petty. And you know, the very first one that came to mind was Junior Johnson. So I'm going to go with Junior Johnson.
Good guesses. You were closer with Maurice Petty. The answer was Robbie Loomis. Robbie, for those of the new fans that didn't know Robbie was the King's last crew chief, the last part of the King's tenure as a driver. And then he stayed as crew chief on the 43 when he went through the different drivers, Wilson, Bobby Hamilton, and all that. And I think he ended up with, when Evernham left Jeff Gordon, he became Jeff Gordon's crew chief. And that's kind of his story. But what Robbie really meant by that, I mean, what that means is you never, ever, ever stop working on these race cars. You never stop. I mean, when you go to bed at night, when you quit working on the car during the day and you go to bed at night as a crew chief, the last thing you're thinking about is what to do to the race car to make it better. What facet of the car, what area am I looking at now? What can we do to make this better? And you come in the next morning and you got the ideas and you're thinking about it and you put it through the simulations, or they do now. And, well, it's a whole different deal, but the thought process is the same. You never stop. And you have to just load the car up and send it to the racetrack. And when you get to the racetrack, you unload it and you get it ready and you start practicing. Well, you continually work. You start working on it again. You work on it right up through qualifying. You work on it for qualifying. Qualifying's over. You work on it for the race, getting it tuned up best you can for the race. You make changes. When the race starts, you start working on it again. You work on it all day during the race or all night during the race. And then when the race is over, you load it up and send it home, and you're going home thinking about, you know, what we did to the car, what we do to make it better. The next morning you wake up and you're back at it again. You're back at it working on the race. You never, ever stop working on these race cars. Ooh. And I thought that was such a neat quote.
That is. Well, what if, let me ask you this. So after you've won a race, I mean, how long does the crew chief and driver for that matter, but mostly the crew chief, how long do you think they even enjoy it? Or is it almost impossible for them? Or they already start thinking about working on the next week's car?
as soon as you come out of the press conferences, you start thinking about it, unless it's an extra special victory and you got the alcohol, the beverages flowing, and that'll kind of numb your senses for a few hours. But once that's over, you're thinking about it. Most of the guys, you're thinking about it on the way home. This is what we did to the car this week, and this is what we did all weekend, and this is what we did today, and look how the car reacted and acted. Now, how are these changes going to work next week when we go to Dover or wherever? If I can apply this or apply that. So your mind is constantly thinking. You're never better than your last race. That's the thing about racing. You're no worse or better than your last race, and you're constantly trying to improve the thing. And let me tell you something, man. Cup racing is hard. You talk to anybody from years before I got into sport, the years I was there, or right now today, the guys that come into it. You know, when you've raced everywhere, when you get to Cup, you've got credentials. You're not going to get to Cup unless you've got some pretty good credentials. And once you get there, all of a sudden you realize, man, this really is the real deal. This is hard, not just for drivers, but for people that work on them, everybody that does everything they do to make this thing go. And you can't really explain to folks how hard it is, what goes on, but just suffice to say that it's a all-time-consuming event in your life when you're involved.
Yeah, it's like that joke about Nick Saban. Like, the problem with Alabama going to the national championship game is it gets in the way of him recruiting. You know, it just gets in the way of him already thinking about and getting to the next year's team. You know, it's just that's that kind of mindset, I guess, it takes to be, well, to get to the top of whatever sport or thing it is you're competing in.
Exactly. That's very good, Ricky. I was proud of that. I'm glad you come up with that.
Well, I finally contributed something today, so that's
good.
Yeah. Okay, Dad, I've heard this story many a times throughout my day, pretty much my whole life, but I want you to share it with all of the good folks out here in MassCast land. Your first race car, I believe you were 15. How did you acquire your first ever race car?
Very short and quick, simple story, Ricky. I had a black 4-H Angus steer that I had raised from a calf and got him up to a good size, grain fed him. He was the meanest old bastard that ever was, anyhow. I don't know why he was so friggin' mean, but you try to feed him and he try to kill you. I'm sitting there thinking, why do animals, if you're trying to take care of them and feed them, why do they want to turn around and eat you or kill you? And that's where this particular steer was. But anyhow, I sold that steer, $575. There's an old guy here locally that had a dirt car and a trailer that he had raced at the local racetrack here at Natural Bridge Speedway. I bought that car and that trailer for $575. And it had a messed up engine. We took the engine apart and got it all going and started my racing career. Actually, I won a race with, I think the sixth race with that car, I won a race. Paid, I believe it was $60. And during that time period, also, I come of age to where I was old enough to get a driver's permit. And before I really got my permit, it was kind of like the learner's permit, but it wasn't really a learner's. It's something in those days you did before the driver's. I don't know what it was. Anyhow, I got a speeding ticket in Lexington, Virginia, 41 and a 25. I go to the judge, or I go to appear before the judge to get my sentencing. I'm guilty. He said, how do you plead guilty? He says, okay, here's a fine. And I forget how much it was. And he looked at me and he says, now, Mr. Mass, you're in school, right? I said, yeah. He said, well, you're going to have to pay this ticket. I says, okay. He says, I don't mean your dad or your family or your friends. I want you to be able to pay the ticket. Do you work where you make extra money to pay the ticket? I said, well, yes, sir, I do. He said, what do you do? And I said, well, I've got a car I race down here at the racetrack. I remember him. He had those little reading glasses on, and he little bald headed dude. And he looked up over those reading glasses at me with those beady eyes. And you could see the fire. Man, you could see the fire coming out of those eyes. And I remember thinking, Rick Mash, you stupid bastard. Why did you say this to that judge? He did not like that. But anyhow, the story was, I used the money to buy the car, won a race six time out. He used racing money to pay for the speeding ticket. And that's kind of the cow story.
Traded a cow for a race car and used the race car to pay for a speeding ticket. There you have
That is correct.
It's a sharp 57 Chevy, too.
It was 57 Chevrolet.
Yep. So wait, you were going 41 and a 25?
That's correct.
Okay, that's not too bad. That's not. That's way better. That's much more safe excessive speeding than what I got in trouble for when I was your age. That's for sure.
Well, yeah, you know the good part of that story. My buddy, it was me and my buddy riding around, and somehow or another we had commandeered a 6-pack of beer. I think it was Schlitz. And when I was getting pulled over, the Schlitz was in the seat, but my buddy took the 6-pack of beer and put it under his feet. And I remember the 57 Chevrolet, that car didn't have, like, under the seat on the passenger side, there wasn't a space. There was some piece of metal blocking, so you couldn't actually stuff the beer under the seat. So he just kind of put his legs over it and tried to keep it hidden, and I guess he did. But because the policeman never saw that, which was a good thing. But we weren't drinking it yet at that point, and because you didn't drink and drive, and you still don't drink and drive. And, of course, times have changed a little bit. But anyhow, we didn't get in as much trouble as we could have.
Yeah, you were en route to drink your Schlitz.
We were en route, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And if you're not too busy wallering around, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. Give us a 5-star rating and leave us a positive review. We'll see you next time on the Mass Cast.